Welcome to the Leadership Window podcast with Patrick Jinks. Each week, through a social sector lens, Patrick interviews leaders and experts and puts us in touch with trends and tips for leading effectively. Patrick is an LSI certified leadership coach, a member of the Forbes Coaches Council, a best-selling author, award-winning photographer, and professional speaker. And now, here's Patrick.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Leadership Window. I'm Patrick Jinks, leadership and strategy coach and president of the Jinks Perspective. Glad you are along for this week's episode. We're almost at the end of the second month of the year. Time flies whether you're having fun or not, I guess. I heard the other day, I think a friend of mine tweeted an article or some piece of research that said that our summer this year, I'm paraphrasing, I'm trying to remember it. Our summer this year should feel a little more like 2019 summer than 2020's summer as it relates to the pandemic and where we are and what we might be able to do and our freedoms and all of that. And I really hope that's true. I hope that this summer does feel much more like 2019 than it did 2020. But we'll see. In the meantime, we just keep pressing on, keep leading on, keep doing what we're doing, try to keep a positive attitude, try to help other people where we can, make sure that we pause, that we take care of ourselves, that we learn through this time, that we intentionally connect with others any way that we can during this time, and that we innovate. What a great opportunity to innovate. I shared at the beginning of this podcast when it started back last year, part of the reason this podcast got released when it did is because of the pandemic. It just, I think it created some creativity. It sparked some necessity to shift and pivot and do some different things. So I hope you're able to do that. This episode's a little bit different. I'm going to actually take this episode, which is episode 29, and next week's episode, episode 30, and I'm going to fly solo because I have been sort of inspired to talk a little bit about things that I've learned about leadership, but in two parts. So part one today is going to be about things I've learned or I'm learning about leadership in school, through academics, through books, through classroom, through the sort of body and theory of knowledge. I am in a PhD program right now in organizational leadership. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment, but I just kind of want to share a little bit about what that experience has been like. I want to highly recommend it. If you have at all an appetite and you've been thinking about jumping into school again, whether it's a bachelor's, a master's, or a doctoral program, I want to highly recommend it if you can do it. And maybe sharing some of my experience and learnings might help you decide if you're kind of on that fence or you've been thinking about it. Next week, in part two, I want to talk about things that I've learned about leadership that I didn't get from school or from a book. Things that I've just kind of learned along the way or learned from mentors or learned from experience. And I will say this as well. When I say I've learned something, you know, that's fairly subjective. Some of my perspective is just exactly that. It's just my perspective. It might be my interpretation of something I've learned. It might be a tenet or a value or a precept on leadership that I believe in because of my unique experience on the journey. And some of those things may not align with your thinking, your values, how you've interpreted some of what's happened. And then much of what I've learned, just like anything else, is factual. It's based on empirical research, peer-reviewed research, years, decades of research. So it's a little bit of a mix. What we learn is just something we take in, and how we interpret it and how we apply it really makes a difference as well. So that'll be next week. We'll talk about what I've learned that I didn't get from a book or a classroom. Today, I want to share a little bit about the educational experience when it comes to learning, particularly about leadership. I think this might some of this might apply to any field of study that you might either be considering or that you have experienced in your own lives. But I want to start just a little bit back to my educational journey and kind of where I am. Next week, I'll be the double nickel. I'll be 55 years old next week. And many people who have their doctorate degrees got their doctorate degrees in their, 20s or 30s even. And some kind of into their 40s, they took a little bit of a break. I feel like this is a little later in life to be doing this. But I'm so absolutely glad that I'm doing it. It has added tremendous value, I think, not only for me, but for the people that I'm serving in my business. And that's what makes it really rich for me. I started college at Louisiana Tech right out of high school, just like, the sort of traditional path, right? You graduate. I had some scholarships and I had some help from my parents to get me going. And I was a journalism major and I went 2 quarters at Tech, Louisiana Tech. They're on a quarter system rather than a semester system. So, I went 2 quarters. I did okay. I made A's and B's and I thought I was going to be a journalist, a newspaper journalist, like an investigative reporter, or maybe a column writer or something like that. But I wanted to be in the field of journalism. My dad was a newspaper man, albeit he was in advertising and not the journalism side. And I was just so convinced I wanted to be in the newspaper business. But I dropped out of college to go to work at a newspaper. And I thought, oh, this, no need for college. If I can go ahead and get in, I don't need college. And I got in on the ground level, not in journalism, but in advertising, working for who? My father, at a small newspaper in North Louisiana, small town, Minden, Louisiana. And I wasn't ready for it, by the way. I failed at it, to be honest with you. I was in retail advertising sales, and I didn't do all that great. I had a lot of maturing to do before I could be successful at that role. But while I was there, I was able to write a weekly column, and it was an inspirational column. And I also had a little bit of experience working for the Tech Talk when I was at Louisiana Tech, and I had a sports beat, and I was writing about the Louisiana Tech basketball team. And this was when Carl Malone was there. I had a history class with the great mailman, Carl Malone. And I just thought, yeah, this is my path. I'm going to do it. Well, it didn't work out, long story short, a little shorter. And I didn't become a journalist. And I did continue ad sales at other newspapers and got a little better at that, actually. And then somewhere along the way, I got roped into a volunteer role at United Way, the nonprofit. And that was back in the early 90s. And when I had the opportunity to join the United Way staff, I jumped on it. That started my real leadership career. I spent over 20 years in the United Way network. I was CEO of 2 United Ways, interim CEO of 2 others. I was on state boards. I was on the National Professional Council. I had a wonderful career at United Way. Well, along the way, my first CEO job for United Way required a bachelor's degree. Guess what? I didn't have it. I dropped out of school. Fortunately for me, I somehow was able to get in the door with a great cover letter and resume. And I guess I knocked their socks off at the interview. It was one of those times where I felt like I was really in the zone and really did well. And they made the exception and they hired me as the CEO of this United Way in Southern Virginia without a bachelor's degree. And they didn't even require that I go pursue one. They just left it to my 7 years of experience that I had at my previous United Way and just my leadership bent that I had, communication style, whatever it was. I sold them. And it was a wonderful 10 years, Danville, Virginia. And while I was there, one of my board members, who shall go unnamed because she wanted to go unnamed. She said, I don't want other people knowing that I ever did this. This is a calling for me. I feel compelled and led to do this. We didn't really know each other that well, but she was a fan of the work that we were doing on our board, and she wanted it to excel. And she was a big supporter of me and what I was trying to do. And she said, you need a college degree. And I said, oh, I would love that, but just not in the car. I mean, at that time, you know, we had both our kids were at home. So here's a family of four on a small nonprofit salary. I wasn't in the financial position to go back to school. I thought maybe one day. And she said, no, we're not going to let finances stop you. So here's what we're going to do. And I'm not going to tell you the rest of the story, but she started me off with a fund through one of the local education foundations to get me my bachelor's degree done. And what she didn't cover, she convinced the United Way board to cover the rest. And I got my bachelor's degree at none other than the University of Richmond, a pretty prestigious private university, a very expensive university, but because of a partnership with Danville Community College, there was a satellite program at a fraction of the cost that we were able to do and get a bachelor's degree from. So because somebody cared enough to make that contribution and invested in me, I got my bachelor's degree from the University of Richmond. And because of that, I got inspired to jump into an MBA program at Danville's own Averett University. Great school, great gym in the middle of this sort of rural, you know, part of the country. And got my MBA at Averett, again, through a little bit of scholarship sort of thing and a little bit of a good bit of support from my organization that I was leading as part of my compensation. And when I was done with that, I thought, okay, that's it. School is kicking my rear. I can't do this anymore. I have an MBA now. This is great. When I go into my leadership coaching business, I've got an MBA, you know, I've got some, maybe that gives me some respect, some credibility. And my wife at the time was going, you've got momentum. You should just keep going. Why don't you just go straight into a PhD program or a doctorate of business administration, get a DBA. And I just, at the time I said, no way. It was far too much on me. And here I am, you know, leading an organization, by now a bigger one, up in Pennsylvania. And there was just no way I was going to do it. And I didn't. And we moved down here to Columbia, South Carolina, where I launched my coaching business full time and left the United Way Network. And I'm not even sure how I came across this, but I think it was either a Google ad or a Facebook ad that came across my feed for a PhD program in organizational leadership. Hello, that's my world, my field. It's what I do with clients. And it was right here at Columbia International University. And I had passed the billboards for Columbia International University, driving up and down the roads here in Columbia. And it's a faith-based university. So it's not a Bible school per se, but it is a faith-based university. And much of their work is done through what they call the biblical lens. And I thought, well, nothing against that. I mean, that's great. I certainly see a lot of value in that. But that made me question, well, what's the accreditation? And what? So, you know, I go and I look and I realize that, well, this is accredited by the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges. Same group that has accreditation for the University of South Carolina and Clemson and a host of other big name universities. So, okay, I had a conversation with the associate provost and said, look, I want, if I'm going to do a PhD program, I want it to be rigorous and I want it to be credible. And boy, you know, he convinced me that it was, and holy moly, sure enough, this thing is, if it's rigorous, okay. A PhD program is not for the light of heart. I will tell you that it's not for the undisciplined, and it's rigorous. And that's the tough side of it. The benefit of it is boy, do you really learn. You learn in ways that you didn't learn in your bachelor's or your master's programs. It's a different kind of learning because you're really having to go out and do the research yourself and kind of become an expert in a field. I'm oversimplifying it, but the person I would say was responsible for me responding to that ad, even though she didn't know I had ever seen it, was my wife, Mary, who had told me, you should just do this. You'll thank yourself. The time will go anyway. You know, you've got this momentum, you can do it. And all that came ringing back to me. And I applied and got accepted. So now here we are. I am, I will finish in December of this year. So we're heading down the home stretch. I'm in the middle of my study on my dissertation, actually conducting the study, and I'm studying mission measurement in the nonprofit sector. That's all I'll say about that right now. But I wanted to share all that because part of the reason I wanted to do this podcast episode was to encourage any of you who have thought about this, you're considering it. I've talked to a number of people, even that I'm coaching, who have said, yeah, I'd like to do that one day. Or I've thought about it, but I just don't know if I have the bandwidth. Or, yeah, I'm kind of dipping my toes in the water. I'm looking at some universities, you know, tell me about CIU. And I just want to say, if you're out there listening and you've been thinking about this, I really just wanted to be a strong advocate for it. If you can pull it off. Now, the difference in this one and my undergrad, well, my bachelor's and master's degree is that I'm paying for this one. well, I could say my company's paying for it, right? But this one I'm paying for. And so when you are personally invested in that way, it also spurs a level of discipline and learning and the value that you intend and commit to getting out of the program. I'm a big believer that in most things you do get out what you put in. So I'm trying to put the best here in, and where in the past I have done some of my work just for the sake of doing it and getting it done and complying so that I can get the grade and get the degree. This isn't that way. This one really inspires me to really not only learn, but to bring my best. I want my dissertation to be a body of work that really informs the sector. And, you know, one of the things that our methodologist at CIU shared with me the other day, she goes, when you defend your dissertation for a fleeting moment, you are the expert in that field. Dissertations are pretty narrow. So it's not just mission measurement of nonprofits. It's, for me, it's how are mid to large size nonprofits in South Carolina measuring their work? And so it's much more specific. And she said, when you defend your dissertation for a fleeting moment, you are the expert in the field. You are the one now contributing a body of knowledge, a work of knowledge, a piece of research to the field of academia, of the sector you're working in, for other leaders who are working in your set, whoever it might be, and for future researchers and PhD students, you are now contributing to the body of knowledge. And that is a tremendous responsibility and accountability to get it right. So it's a little different. The learning and the investment and what you really want to get out of it, you really want to give your best. So I want to encourage you, if you're thinking about it, if you can at all find a way, and there's usually a way, you won't hate yourself for it. Now, I want to share quickly with you a few things that I've learned in this process, and I'll come back, I'm sure, once I am able to officially put the PhD letters behind my name in my email signature. I'll come back and do a follow-up episode, but here's what I'm learning so far, and I just want to share maybe five things with you. Number one, my studies in organizational leadership have been a reinforcement of an ethical framework that we learned at the University of Richmond. And the ethical framework we learned was that a moral temptation is a choice between right and wrong. An ethical dilemma is usually a choice between right and right. An ethical dilemma, the reason it's a dilemma is which action, which response, which commitment or behavior is more right than the other one? Long-term versus short-term, for example. Mercy versus justice. We based our work on a text by Rushworth Kidder called How Good People Make Tough Choices. And in this PhD program, studying leadership theory, everything from agency theory to steward leadership theory, all the theories on transformational leadership, all the academic theories, it's been a real reinforcement that there's not a single theory that is, this is the one. This is the one that researchers say is the way to do leadership. Instead, it's more of a right versus right. There are pieces of value in all of the different constructs and styles of leadership. So it really is just sort of reinforcing what my clients and coaches have heard me say for years now, that there's more than one right answer. And that has been one of the beautiful things about this program is we're not learning the way to lead. We're learning the ways to lead. And a lot of it is contextual leadership, which is kind of theory of its own, situational leadership. To simplify this, authoritative dictatorial leadership is called for sometimes. Think about a crisis. If there's a fire or if there's an emergency, we don't have time for distributed leadership and a committee meeting and a creative process of getting all the consensus of all the stakeholders, right? You need someone to make the call and say, this is what we're doing. There are other situations where that's the absolute last thing you want if you want to really be effective in where you're going. So there's more than one right answer. The second thing that maybe has stood out to me the most, it's a real simple concept, though you could spend years studying the complexities of it, is the difference between servant leadership and steward leadership. For many years, I've heard the term servant leadership. It became really popular, I think a little bit longer after Greenleaf wrote about it, I think in 1970, the first seminal initial paper on servant leadership. And I've known people who I would consider servant leaders, and I've known people who consider themselves to be servant leaders, whether they are or not. I don't really know. I haven't had the experience with them. But when I see servant leaders, and by the way, there's a lot of servant leadership mentality in the sector I work in, which is the nonprofit sector. People who are CEOs in the nonprofit sector, most of us got there because we really wanted to make a difference. We wanted to be mission driven and not just profit driven. So there's a lot of servant mentality in the sector, even without really sort of fully understanding what true servant leadership is. And the biggest takeaway that I learned is that what many people in the nonprofit sector think is servant leadership is probably actually steward leadership. And here's the basis of it. Servant leadership is about serving others, meaning every other. Servant leadership is all about the others. It's who you're leading is who you're serving. And therefore, it's sort of to whom you're accountable. And so it can be in groups. It can be on teams. It's very much also individual. And there really isn't a construct for who owns what's being led. In steward leadership, it's different because the leader is shepherding or stewarding the resources of some owner. So they're operating on behalf of an owner. In the nonprofit sector, the true ownership of an organization is the community at large, because they're the ones both, covering it through tax exemption, and they're also the ones donating to the organization, and they are the ones to whom the organization is accountable to just in their IRS tax exempt status. The IRS takes nonprofits' word for it that we're going to deliver a mission for our community, for the benefit of our community. So the board doesn't own the nonprofit. They're accountable for it, but they don't own it. They are sort of the chief stewards. The ownership is the community. And so when you think about that, this is where it came up in one of my coaching conversations last year is I was coaching an executive who was really struggling with disciplining, particularly terminating an employee of their nonprofit. Because as a servant leader, they felt like my responsibility is to this employee. I want to do everything I can to help them succeed. And boy, firing them just doesn't do it. It just doesn't feel like servant leadership. And we got to talking about the difference between steward leadership and servant leadership. And as a steward leader, your job is not just to maintain and protect the resources, it's to grow the resources and create impact with the resources. So if you've got a staff person that's not creating impact, that's not contributing or performing at the level they need to in order to drive the mission, it is actually true, pure stewardship to address that and solve it one way or the other. So the idea that terminating an employee can constitute steward leadership in a very positive way was a real eye-opener, I think, for this individual that I was coaching. And it's come up a number of times. It's just the difference of understanding that I can't necessarily please everybody. And I think servant leadership sometimes tends to attempt that. Steward leadership is about pleasing the owner, which means if I'm both protecting the integrity of the resources of the owner and I'm growing them. In our studies, we talked about the parable of the talents in the Bible, where the keeper of the estate gives a certain number of talents to three of his stewards. And one of them comes back and says, I took my five and turned it into 10. And it's well, good. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. You were faithful with a little, and now I'm going to give you a lot. And this was the case with the first two. The third one came and said, I buried my talents, my treasures, in order to protect them. And here it is. I've still got it. I still have what you gave me. And that steward got rebuked for not growing the resources. I don't want you to just bury it. The idea is that you do something with it. So when you are the CEO of a nonprofit organization, your job is not just to balance the budget and protect the resources and make ethical decisions. It's to grow the resources, to leverage them, to multiply them, and to create impact with them. So if you've got something that's in your way of doing that, something that's truly impeding that work, it's your job as the CEO to address that. And that does not take away your servanthood or your stewardship. It actually exercises it. Some of the studies that we went through in servant versus steward was that the mindset of servant leadership is actually a subset of steward leadership. In other words, if you just imagine, you know, concentric circles, for example, with stewardship being the bigger circle and servant leadership being inside that circle as a circle of its own. So there is a sense of humility and serving others and empathy and advancing others. Leadership is about advancing others, but through a steward lens, it's about a mission of that's not just an individualized sort of mission. I'm probably not doing it justice, but it was a real revelation for me to understand that servant leadership and steward leadership are slightly different, and that in the sector where I'm working and coaching, steward leadership is really what's called for. Let me move to the next concept. The third one that I think it's been more of a reinforcement is the idea of self-determination theory. And some of you listening to this are like, yo, boy, I've heard you talk about this many, many times, and you will continue to hear me talk about it. I really do believe this is a center point of leadership. Self-determination theory basically holds that people in a workplace, for example, in this context, are really motivated and driven by three things. And they are autonomy, competence, and relatedness. Autonomy, not meaning, you know, that I don't answer to anybody, but autonomy meaning I have some degree of control over how my job gets done. I have some sense of decision-making and some influence over how it gets done. The competence is I'm good at what I do. In fact, Daniel Pink in his book Drive talks about self-determination theory in probably more lay terms and through some great stories. The competence he calls mastery. He uses a different term for it, but people are engaged when they know they have mastery over what they do. It feels great to be good at what you do and know that that's valued. And the third thing is relatedness. And in self-determination theory, the relatedness is that the employee in this example feels a sense of identity, a sense of identification with the organization and its leaders or leader. So it's sort of a two-pronged relatedness. I feel a sense of belonging and identity and connection with the mission, and I feel a sense of belonging and identity and connection with the leader. Those three things, autonomy, competence, and relatedness, or what Daniel Pink calls purpose, drive employee engagement. And there's tons of the employee engagement research from Gallup and SHRM and Dale Carnegie and all through academia that affirms the notion of self-determination theory. So as a leader, as an organizational leader, the work is actually shaping a path, creating an environment where the employees can exercise the greatest degree of autonomy feasible, experience and develop and utilize mastery or competence and feel connected to a sense of purpose and a shared vision with the leader. And that's kind of a segue into number four. And that is something I've often said. I'm definitely learning it. It's this course for me is affirming of my own philosophy that the term soft skills is a term I don't particularly prefer when it comes to leadership. I've heard it all my life. The soft skills of leadership, right? The ability to communicate well, or the ability to interact with someone well, or the empathy. They call empathy a soft skill. I don't understand the term. I guess you could probably make an argument for why it's called that. To me, it's not the soft skills of leadership. It is leadership. Those things are leadership. Creating this environment where people can thrive, where people feel a sense of autonomy, mastery, and purpose, that's the work. Leadership is the work. And so this is going to segue actually into my fifth and final one in this category of what I've learned in my program. I'm coaching a lot of leaders, both mid-level leaders and CEOs of smaller organizations, who have to have their hands on two sides of the equation. They're leading a team, they're leading people, but they also have their own body of work and performance on their plate. So they kind of have shared duties. And the difficulty is how do you combine those two and balance those two, where my work is leadership, but my work is also, I'm the one who does the budget, or I'm the one who runs this program, or I'm the chief fundraiser in the organization, versus a situation where my job is not fundraising, it's not financial management, it's not program management, it's not admin, it's leadership. That is the job. And so if you define leadership as influence, influencing others to excel, to accomplish the mission, that's it. It's not soft skills. It's inspiring people with vision. It's modeling the way. It's showing empathy. It's developing others. It's challenging others. It's coaching others. That is the work. So when you've reached a place where leadership is the job, it is the work, then you probably have a team of competent people who are able to do the performance side of the work. And if you don't yet have that, then you got to develop that first. But that's just sort of the fourth tenet here, is that leadership has nothing to do with soft skills. What has traditionally been called the soft skills, that is leadership. And one of the things that I have spent a lot of my time helping particularly CEOs understand is that they have to make a mindset shift from being the high individual performer that they once were to being the high impact leader that their team needs them to be. And it's two very different things. And it has a lot to do with speed as well, which I think is more something I've learned outside the classroom. But I'll talk about that next week. And then so the fifth one, again, all related, the fifth one, one of the things that's resonated most with me is the difference between transformational leadership theory and transactional leadership theory. Transformation versus transaction. I'm probably going to oversimplify this because it's a podcast and we've got a short amount of time. But really, as I study more about these two theories, the best way I would summarize them is to say that transformational leadership is leadership and transactional leadership is management. It sounds exactly what transactional leadership is exactly what it sounds like. It's you do this for this. That's our deal. I pay you this. You create this many widgets, right? I give you this amount of authority. You create this with it, or you lead this, or you're accountable for this. So it's an exchange. It's part of it is social exchange theory as well. And I'm just, you can Google these things, go to Google Scholar and look at some of these things yourself if you want to learn more about them. But transactional leadership is exactly what it sounds like. It's we're going to make a transaction. You're going to do what I need done, and this is going to be your reward for it. And it kind of goes into another whole area of leadership on the sources of power and the levels of leadership. In other words, you do this because I have the authority to tell you to do it, or there are consequences. So the base of power there is coercive power or reward power. So this is French and Raven, by the way, if you want to look up bases of power, French and Raven, this is where it comes from. And so is my leadership power based on my ability to reward or penalize? Or is my leadership based on what they called referent power, where there's a sense of respect and a desire to follow the leader? Talked about Eisenhower's definition of leadership many times, getting people to do things you want done because they want to do it. Well, that's transformational leadership. So transformational leadership is all about getting people to do things because they get a sense of fulfillment in actually doing it. There's a sense of mission fulfillment. It connects to self-determination theory because the people you're leading are doing it because they feel a sense of identity and connection with and passion for the purpose, the greater cause. Whether it's personal, I'm getting development from this, I'm growing as a human being for this, or whether it's mission related, I'm making a contribution, I'm making a difference for others. So that difference between transformation and transformational leadership and transactional leadership has been a big one. Man, there's just so many more things, but so far in the program, I would say those are kind of the five tenets. I've also learned in this program, this is kind of a bonus, number six maybe, and it's not so much about leadership as it is about going to school. And that is, man, I'm learning how to code data. I'm learning how to study more effectively. I'm learning how to research credible data and respect credible data more. It's just been enlightening that way. I'm also learning that the more I learn, the more I realize I don't know. Ralph Sockman who said, the larger the island of knowledge, the longer the shoreline of wonder. Let that sink in a little bit. The larger the island of knowledge, the longer the shoreline of wonder. The more unexplored shoreline there is. And boy, it's true. You learn more and you realize, oh my goodness, I know nothing at this point. I really know so little. And so, there was a time when I was probably a little cocky about what I knew, what I thought I knew about leadership. And it was because I had performed and I had gotten some people's attention and I'd gotten some level of position. And I relied heavily on sort of innate talents and thought, well, I know a lot. I'm not there anymore. Part of it's age and maturity as a human and just experiences. But this program is humbling and it's just incredible. So I'm gonna wrap this episode up, but I will also tease an upcoming episode. that we have coming up with Dr. Brian Simmons, and he's Associate Provost at Columbia International University, where I'm in my PhD in organizational leadership work. And we're going to talk more about steward leadership, and we're going to talk about more about the academics of leadership and other things like that. So I'm looking forward to that. And then, of course, next week, like I said, we're going to talk about some things. I'm just going to share my perspective, the Jinx perspective, on things I've learned about leadership. But next week, it's going to be things I've learned about leadership that I didn't get, that you really probably can't get from a college course or even a book. You just have to experience it and have to see it. And everyone out there listening to this has a book in them. You could be the writer. Because there is one thing you're an expert on, and that is your personal experience. So I just want to share some of mine with you next week. Until then, folks, lead on.